Okay, we've talked about recharge. We've talked about infiltration. Now, there's one token talk on drainage, which a lot of us are dealing with more and more, especially of the agricultural variety. So I drafted one of my colleagues, Tim Gillette, and he gladly agreed to give us a talk on drainage. And Tim is a conservation drainage engineer with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, which is the shop that we both work in. And he's going to be talking about controlling groundwater levels in agricultural landscapes with drain tile and drainage water management. But I can't resist adding that Tim might be the only drainage engineer that also has a divinity degree. So he has spent a large chunk of his professional life dealing with other people's problems. Anyway, Tim Gillette.
Bless you. Okay. That's the introduction I didn't want. The subject is one that I'm curious of my audience, actually, to find out what history you or what experience you have with agricultural drainage. We've been talking about all sorts of movement of groundwater. When we move into the agricultural landscape, there's rules that say that they sort of have a right to do what they want to do with groundwater. So I want to find out how many of you come out of a farm or agricultural rural background. That's a small number, folks. Okay, how many of you are townies? Yeah, okay. We've come out of the suburban or the small town or the metropolitan areas like we're in right now. That has probably been the most difficult part of the my tasking, is that I was and still am a civil engineer. Most of my activity had been in the private sector, working in landscapes that were urbanized or were rural and going to be urbanized. And so this interaction that we see with groundwater here is almost as new to me as it will be to some of you. As we think about it, and let's see if I know how to make this thing go forward. Yeah, there we go. I'm going to get to modern history quickly. I was sitting at a table at lunch today, and people knew about what I would consider ancient history in the United States, about Native American tribes and how they lived and how they passed away and all sorts of things like that. Well, I'm going to show you a little bit of how we sort of urbanized or at least colonized and civilized the drainage in the rural areas of Minnesota. These are dredges that were used in the 1800s and 1900s, they literally floated on the water and took soil out of the ditches as they moved along, with the total desire of draining large amounts of property so that people could come in, settle it, and farm it. And so these places would actually have a cook, operators, mechanics, everybody living on board as they would go across the plains. Well, somebody had a great idea that was actually an ancient idea that they brought over from Europe. John Johnston, father of tile drainage in the United States, brought into New York State clay tile molds that had been used in Europe for centuries, and actually we have them back all the way to Persia and beyond. We have existing tiles that were used for the very purpose of draining the ground so that it would be available for, in this particular case, agriculture, being able to get the water out so that it could be used to produce, not just produce, but produce higher yields. So we used to hand dig all this stuff in. Just think about this, though. They hand dug 72 miles of tile on 320 acres on his farm, on John Johnston's farm. This stuff is put in, when it was put in back in that day, it was put in like 7 or 8 feet deep. And they dug it down by hand and put in the tile sections to drain their property so that he literally became not just a modeler of this, but became, he actually bought up or helped people who had been making pottery were now making clay tiles and shipping them all over the East Coast. We got into some more modern machinery, and we get into a kind of trenching that is done by steam equipment, and now you can put in hundreds of feet instead of tens of feet worth of tile in a day, and you can put in bigger pipes. But now we don't do that anymore. We can put in miles a day with GPS equipment. That's a GPS-guided plow. You can put it into slope. No matter what your surface is doing, it'll put it into an exact slope for the pipe so it'll drain. And so using plastic pipe instead of clay, obviously, so that we're now using flexible pipe. And if you've done any traveling out in the hinterlands, you've seen these trucks that have been piled high with these black coils. That's drain tile that's headed out to our fields. In 2012, the Bois de Sioux watershed, this is one watershed in the drainable areas of our state, put in 2,900 miles of drain tile in 1 year. So we've been draining. We drain urban settings. We've been hearing about it today, roads, agriculture. We're going to talk mostly about agriculture, but we started with drainage ditches, and we've moved to subsurface, but they have the same purpose. They're always for the same purpose. It is to control the groundwater level. What is the desire of any farmer that's farming is to get in on the at the right time, as soon as it is physically possible to do work in their fields, they want to get in. They want to get as much water off as fast as it can go. So you would want to, in the case of a drain tile or a ditch, you want to have it getting as close to the source of the water as possible. So you'll see that many times that distance in some of the old laid tile, you might have gotten to a 30-foot separation between drain tiles at 4-foot depth. Going back to the reason we drain, we like livable cities. Probably if we checked, and I have never done this, but I just have a sense for it, the amount of wetlands that were dislodged or removed in the suburbs and the city of Minneapolis, probably. Well, you can see a number of the existing ones are still in Richfield along 35. You know that there's a lot of wetlands. There was a lot of them just bulldozed right in and filled in, and a large amount of the housing is on them. Protecting roads and travelers, making sure that our road surfaces stay vital. If you have water up against them, anybody who's constructed roads know that you'll lose your structure and your roads go to pieces. And that's why you see in some of the rural areas, especially if you look at township roads, one of the reasons that they have the load limits in the spring is because the material that's underneath isn't able to handle the freeze-thaw pumping that happens in the spring. And the water that's in it is because they've literally got, in some of the township roads, just the rolled-over edges of the old fields. And they became the farm roads. Okay, the last turning of the wheel or of the plow flipped off the dirt, and they did it on both sides. That's what made their their road for their farm. The farm got turned over. The farm road got turned over to the township. The township then turned it over to the county, and so some of your road systems are built on this kind of material. So protecting the roads is you got to drain them, and so you have large road ditches that we use for that purpose. Protecting and enhancing human health, and then. And I always put this last, but when you move, all you have to move is about 15, 20 miles from this place, and you're going to find that the people have a very different orientation toward this. They're going to flip this to the top side. They're going to make number four the most important thing. Drainage and health, I just wanted to give you this, because when I found this out, this was really interesting. This comes from Bruce Wilson here at the U. And 1830s, work stopped in Illinois and Michigan on the canal they were building. The cost of malaria was too much. Illinois settlements abandoned because of malaria in the 1830s. This isn't all that long ago, folks. That's 180 years. That's not a long time. 66 cases per 1,000 people per year between 1829 and 1838 died of malaria in Fort Snelling. Dr. Mayo moved up here from Indiana because he was trying to get away from malaria. Okay, and I always thought of malaria as something that happened down in the Panama Canal. No, it happened because of the undrained lands that we've had in the northern areas, and a lot of the draining that we saw in the fields was actually to get rid of the water so that the bugs couldn't live. When we design drainage in the agricultural setting, we do it based on all the things we've talked about today. Soils, water, rainfall, water cycle, the topography, climate, and land use. All the same things that we've been talking about as we've been talking about design of and mitigation of the things that we have difficulties with in groundwater. So we look at the hydrologic groups just like we do in any, even when we're doing storm ponds and when I was designing them as a practicing engineer, we would have been working heavily with these groups. We also would be looking at the rainfall charts, and this is an old one. As many of you know, the NOAA 14 has come out, and a number of things have changed about it, but we would use these things to design our ponding and that type of thing in the urban setting. In the rural setting, you use it to keep track of what your rainfall is going to be like so you know how much you need to drain, how much water you need to get through the soil, how much water you need to get out of that drain tile so that you can get in for operation in the spring and also in the fall. So you've got this is a much more complicated one. I really like that one, if I could get that slide. The one we saw first today of the water cycle, this one actually has volcano in it for steam and all sorts of other things in it. However, I like this one better. This one's got little smiley faces on all the droplets. This is the one we use for the kids, but it suits me very well. But you can see, and this is important for me because I'm not a groundwater guy, I'm a surface water guy that has come into that interface between groundwater and the water cycle. Because as we begin to look at how water gets to us, we also have to begin to look at how do we get groundwater recharge occurring. I'm very aware, not just because of my background in engineering, but I'm very aware we're in a wet area. I grew up in Michigan. I grew up on spring-fed lakes and eutrophying lakes as well, ones that were dying. We got some really great bass in those places. But you can see in all of the agricultural properties of the Midwest, Minnesota has the second most land that would benefit from having some kind of improved drainage. And as you look at it, the only one that comes out even close to it is Ohio, and that's actually the lake lobe. Of of Lake Erie. It's the tailing off there, and it's really flat property, and it doesn't drain very well. Okay, so we have a need to drain if we're going to do agriculture. The land that you're looking at here is extremely flat. This is 0 to 0.5% or 0 to 1% kind of land. It's really flat. So when we're working with the land and we're beginning to talk about the water cycle, we also talk about the water balance, which has been discussed a number of times. And so the partitioning of the soil profile is important to a farmer. He wants to know what does he have really available to his plants, what is available, and then also what does he need to get rid of. Well, we have hygroscopic water, which is this is the water that if you're in a laboratory, this is what you bake off to find to finally get to the place where you actually have the material alone, okay, the soil alone. And so this isn't going anywhere. This isn't, you're not draining this away. There's a second non-drainable item or a water piece that's in here also, and that's the plant available water. This is water that is trapped in such a way as it won't drain. It doesn't go by capillary action. It's being held by the tension of the particles and everything. And so you have a surface tension that's holding this in place, and the plants can get to it, but you're not going to be able to get it to drop out and come to your drain. Then you have the drainable water. Now, the drainable water is just that. It's water that can and for agricultural purposes has to come out of the water, out of the soil profile, if you're going to be able to work that property. And then if you were in a natural state, you'd have depressional water, okay? You'd have a amount of water that you could assume would be there for the potholes that all the duck hunters in amongst us are screaming about, because we're losing them everywhere because we're now draining them. Okay, the potholes of the West were the migratory channels for the waterfowl that. We get our ducks, our geese, and I guess recently I heard that there was some kind of swans and some other things that we've seen locally, and also some pelicans that just showed up recently. So we're a pathway, and that depressional water has been over centuries and millennia has been for the purposes of that migratory task. And then we have surface runoff. Once you get the depressions filled up, any rainfall that comes, obviously, is going to run off. So we have some key water storage categories we use. One is retention. That is something that where we're trying to keep water for a long time. So it's like lakes and permanent pools and even in our ponding that we do design. Detention is a shorter period of time. We're only doing it for hours or days. It's trying to take the storm bounce out of the water so that it goes slowly down the stream rather than cascading down and tearing things up as it goes. So without subsurface drainage, we get retention storage of the hygroscopic and the plant available, which is pretty much a retention anyway. And then we get the retention also, though, with the drainage water, the drainable water and the surface depression water, both of those are still in the as retention. Problem is, other than the surface runoff, when we begin to play with the subsurface drainage, we get rid of retention, we make a detention, and we drain it out, and the depressions go away, and we have less surface runoff. Why? Because the surface runoff will go fill those potholes, then run off. So it'll be trapped, and then it'll go down into the drains rather than going off. So you get less surface water runoff in a subsurface drainage situation. However, you've increased the you've increased the actual total runoff off of the property because you now have put it into the tile underneath, and it heads out that way. Fate of drainable soil profile and surface depression water. We evaporate it. We talked about that today with ET, transpiration from the plants. We have infiltration, and we have the drain via tile. Here's that interaction that we've been talking about and walking through a number of different ways. This is an issue that is still widely discussed amongst those who are working in drainage, both on the research side as well as in the practice side. First of all, we don't know how much we're actually infiltrating into the deeper recharge regions. We don't have that information. We don't really know what's going on. We can make some guesses, though, in that when we drain, that we're cutting off that cycle. We're getting great infiltration. We're increasing the infiltrated waters, if you will, but we short-circuit it. We don't get it into the recharge regions. And so it's not getting down into the places where it can recharge our groundwater systems. And so as to quantity and all that, we don't have answers on that. One of my concerns, and I'm not a researcher, but it is one of those things that as you continue to live around researchers and as you talk with people who are interested in conservation, my issue is more water quality in the infiltration recharge issue than it is one of worrying about how much, because it was a 1-2% kind of thing anyway in the past. My concern is that we are putting nitrogen into whatever we're recharging, and that we're putting some of those chemicals that don't break down well unless they're oxidized, that we're putting them into the groundwater systems. And we don't have good data. There isn't a lot of studies that have been done below this drain tile location. I think that's a place where we need to continue to work. As we do our actual drainage design, we do talk about the topography. And as I was saying, most of the places that we want to put drainage in are flat. We like to, if it's got any kind of slope to it, what do you need for underground drainage or anything? It naturally drains, right? But as you begin to get flatter and flatter, your topography becomes a foe. It becomes an enemy to you because you can't get the water off. They had to create, and in most of the places, if you go north and west, you'll begin to find that a lot of the drains, the tile drains, are done with an actual pumped outlet because they don't have an outlet available to them that is that would allow for slope in their pipes. Climates are changing, and you know this and I know this, but if you look, I don't know if you can see it. Here's a tabular view of now become. I showed it to you before. I didn't call it out to you. It's 6.1 for a 24-hour, 100-year storm. You're talking about an increase of 1.2 inches for that storm. 1.2 inches. So we're getting higher intensities in the upper storms. Actually, in some of the lower storms, it's being lessened. There's less water coming with those storms. And so what we're seeing now is large events. And somebody, I've been having real problems keeping track because I've been trying to listen to the one and remember the last one. But there was a discussion about the fact that a lot of what was being experienced was event-driven. Well, this is what we're finding now in our hydrology, is that we're beginning to see the way in which storms are coming to us are much more intense, and they're happening in a shorter duration. And as we have seen most recently, it's happened mostly in the spring, and there's not much in the summer anymore. In the most recent days. Whether that's climate or weather, you can debate that with Mark Seeley. I'm at the present time, though, suggesting that this is now a 30-year cycle average that's used here, and we've gone up an inch of water in a 24-hour period. That's a lot of water on any landscape. So we do land use. We use SES that's still being used, even with the new water things. But if you were to go and look really closely, and it's going to be very difficult to do that from anywhere, even the first row would have difficulty, you can see that, though, if you were to look at it close, that bare ground is it's going to produce a great deal of runoff. It's like a hard surface. And so bare ground would be a field after harvest, or before planting, before plants come up in the spring. So bare ground, it's almost like having a gravel road on a clay soil. It's not going to go in; it's going to go down. And so these kinds of land use issues, if you were to look close and go from bare soil down to row crops, they have a high density. The water will run off quickly off of even a row crop situation. We are producing a high amount of runoff compared to what would be natural perennial prairie in our case in the state of Minnesota. You would have gotten probably something in the range of about a 50% decrease in the amount of runoff if you'd had the grasslands of the prairie. So part of that is also intensifying what's happening in our, we're getting more runoff, we're getting more water by the rainstorms, we're getting more water. It may be infiltrating, but it's being grabbed and sent down into our streams, and you begin to get this kind of thing in the rural areas, especially the downstream properties where they've been doing tiling above them. There's more water coming to them in a way that they have no way. There's no outlets able to withstand that. So, when we drain, Dr. R. Wayne Skaggs is the father of drainage. He's the one who designed what's called DrainMod, which is a modeling program that's used to design drainage in the field. His statement is, drain only what is necessary for good soil conditions and crop growth and not a drop more. Okay? Well, if you live in a rural area, you know that that isn't the language of the farmer. That's the language of somebody who's saying, man, I hope you put some brakes on this thing. Because he knows, and we all know, that the way that agriculture deals with it, I want it all off, I want it all off now. And so they drain as fast as they can, and they drain as much as they can. And it puts the soil at risk. It puts the downstream properties at risk. It puts the streams and rivers at risk because of the flow patterns that are occurring in our streams. And while it is a huge debate, and I'm not going to get into the middle of it and tell you which way I feel it goes, we've got a debate in the state of Minnesota about erosive rivers that is ongoing because of and how it's tied to drainage. So this becomes an issue. We have increased loss of nitrates and soluble constituents, and we have increased total runoff contributing to erosion and flooding downstream. Those become a concern, so what do we do? Is there anything that we can do about that? We've done the same kind of design for 30 years and more. Before that, they didn't design it. They just put it in and put it in as close as they could and to drain. Okay, so they've got a nice design pattern. They find out whether it's worthwhile to drain at all, and they may find out it's not cost-effective to do that. It's really marginal land, and they shouldn't be draining it in the first place. They even shouldn't be farming it. Other times, they'll find out that their outlet doesn't have capacity or availability to be able to put drainage water into it, and they shouldn't be designing. Otherwise, though, they're going to start going through a pattern which is pretty standardized about selecting drainage coefficient, which is how many inches are you going to drain per hour, okay? And go through that process. You determine sizes and all that kind of thing. You discern. You do a layout of the property, and then you install it. The common tile design in the past would have been run your pipes uphill, put a main at the bottom, and drain it down the slough, right? That common tile design is not the one that's suggested anymore. We can see, you can maybe, actually all the way to the back, you should be able to see some of these vertical lines. Those aren't cultivation lines. Those are drain tiles, pattern drain tile that is in place in this particular location, and I won't tell you where it is. It is in the state of Minnesota, though. The best tile layout that we know is it still gets to drain the wet spots, so that it keeps the farmer happy. But we place the laterals on contours so that you're putting your laterals, that is the literally the thing that picks up the water, along the contour, and then as you come down the hill, you're going to bring it down with the mains, and those mains then will head out to a place where they will hit outlet. So the golden rule is still there, right? Drain only what is necessary for good soil conditions and crop growth, and not a drop more. And then here's the proviso. This is a risk tolerance issue for the producer. If I don't get enough out, I'm not going to be able to produce that 180 bushel yield that I need to. In this particular case, as commodity prices now have begun to soften again, it's beginning to get closer and closer to break even. Anything I can do to keep my yield in place, I've got to do. Okay, it wasn't so bad. You might, you'd just be a little less rich if you had a 10 bushel loss in the last 2 years. But this year, with the drop in value of the commodity, we've got a problem. They're in a risk situation. So they are looking to the calculators by their drain tilers use some kind of a method that will give them the best kind of drainage they can get, still does what they need it to do, and yet try to be a conservationist in the middle of that. Try that with your business if you own one. It's not an easy thing to do. You're running in between two. It's a social need and a fiscal, financial need within your own situation. Difficult thing to do. So we have drainage tools trying to give it as exacting a direction as can be done. Prinsco's got them. Drain Mod was the one before it, and this one is from Iowa State. You can get them up online. There are readily available to farmers and to tilers. But we use a different methodology. As we, the reason that we want to see them, and this isn't just we, Bowser, but it's those who are doing conservation drainage in the world. That's NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service under the USDA, the University of Minnesota Extension. All of us are trying desperately to, especially where we're seeing so much tiling going in, trying to get people to understand drainage water management, because we know they have to. If we're going to stay the breadbasket to the world, we've got to have good yields. We got to have good production in our fields, but we need to control that somehow. And so we have drainage water management, which is the process of managing tile drainage water discharges from surface and/or subsurface agricultural drainage systems, trying to put some kind of control on this so that we deal with the issues of nitrogen and sediment transport, which, as we've heard today, phosphorus is attaches itself to sediment, and we also have a soluble version of phosphorus, which is also in that water. All of these things are quantified. Just about every study is going to do it for us. We've got to find some way to manage it, and so the way that they did to us was to help the agricultural community see and understand the value of controlling their resource, because that's the language it's got to take now. They have two major resources in the agricultural community. One is their soil, and the other one is the water that they have available to or not available to them. And so these things now, all of a sudden light bulbs are going on in a lot of farmers' heads and going after the last 2 years of pretty much end-of-year droughts that we've had. They're all looking and going, man, I wish I'd been able to hold some of that rainstorm that hit me in April, you know, and be able to do something about that. Well, hopefully we'll be able to see, able to educate them that this is what the precipitation does every year. We get next to none in January, February. We have next to none in November and December and October. But from March on into September, we have a sizable amount of rain that comes. In the native veg situation, the native vegetation does this. I watch it in my yard every year. You know, when the rain goes away, my grass begins to go dormant. It's the natural way that things have worked. Problem is, we've got a very different cycle on the agricultural properties, and we've got an annual crop that is giving away its water at a very different time than the water's coming. Okay, it needs its water in the end of the season when it's big and it's got these great big leaves and it's throwing off all sorts of water through its through the system, and yet its water's not available because it's already tailing off. So you get a desire by the farmer to drain at the front end, and what's he going to do at the back end? He's going to irrigate because he's got to have water for the growing cycle, right? Well, all that water, that drainage water right there that they sent down the stream, probably flooded somebody down the stream someplace or knocked down a levee in Missouri or took their sediment all the way to the Gulf and added to the hypoxia, they could have held that water back. And that's what drainage water management is about. Improved water quality, reducing nitrates, loading to the streams, not concentration, because the concentration stays the same, but the water doesn't. Because what happens is when you hold water back, it becomes a part of the cycle of ET again. We go to some potential denitrification of the water that occurs in being held back in the ground where the bacteria can get to it in the soil. And so you have some natural things that are occurring. So we're reducing the nitrate loading. We improve the soil environment for vegetative growth because there's water when it's needed. The soil and the nutrients that are available there and the water are in proximity to each other, and vegetation grows better. We reduce the soil matter oxidation. So if you hold water up, and those of you that have studied soils, you know that carbon material that is in it gets oxidized, turns into CO2 if you turn it, right? That's why the prairies were, when they opened up the prairies, that was probably the largest CO2 emission ever known to man, because they took and turned it, and it oxidized all that carbon that was just plowed into that soil. We're still doing it. There are some properties here in Minnesota that still have another 8 feet or so of that kind of soil that they're trying to mine. Well, that's good if you want to mine it to zero, but it's not good if you want to keep that so that you have access for the biological things that need to go on in your soils, as well as the need to hold on to that organic material that literally creates a water sink. It for every percent of soil matter, the biological matter that's available in there, you get a 1-inch reservoir, 1 inch of water on that property. That's amazing. That means that 1 year storm is completely taken up in the water profile and doesn't have to be drained away. And actually, it's not easily drained away because it becomes plant available and it doesn't become drain available right away. So it's a great thing if we can hold that water back, begin to build that vegetative soil matter up, and we reduce that oxidation, it becomes a value to the farmer. Then reducing wind and water erosion, wetter soils don't blow around very well, okay? And obviously water erosion, because we're creating a way for the water to go down and infiltrate so it doesn't run off, and it creates a situation where you don't get as much runoff. You continue to not get as much runoff on the surface. We enable seasonal soil saturation. Here's where we put the potholes back in place. Seasonally, we bring the water surface back up to a place where it holds water, and it makes it possible for that to saturate the ponds, local ponds, for purposes of waterfall on a seasonal basis. Reduce the drainage contribution to peak flows. This is huge out in our western areas. The design chart, the only thing we've done is we've added something. We added management zones. These are structures that will be put in for control. Stop log, which is the one on the left there. This is an inline water gate. Both of them are used for controlling water levels in your field, holding water back. The flatter your property is, the better these work. They become less cost-effective, obviously, if you've got a steep property where you have to put one in. They only control like a foot to a foot and a half a piece. So, you know, you get 6 or 7 feet, and you pretty much start burning things up fast in terms of elevation change. In this case, there's two structures, 24 acres on one and 27 acres on the other, controlled to 2 foot. There's a 2 foot control in terms of contours. That makes it possible to hold all that water back, 2 foot of water across the, all the way across. And then during the winter time, you would hold it up to 6 inches from the surface. Huge sink of water storage. So the considerations we have, I'm not going to go into, just because they're design issues that you probably are not interested in. But again, this drainage water management is to control soil water elevations. No different than what the original agricultural drainage systems were for. But we're doing it with a different timing on the discharges. That's the key. Changing that discharge, and also in the case of two items, very quickly, as I see my time is about gone, we have two things that we use pretty regularly in terms of treating that drainage under subsurface drainage water. One is a denitrifying bioreactor. It's literally, we call it a wood chip bioreactor because it's a trench, can be 15 by 150 or or 20 by 200, but it's a sizable trench filled with about 3 to 4 foot worth of wood chips. And you run, you divert the water out of your mains, which is nitrogen rich. You pour it into the wood chips, and the wood chips become the carbon source for the biological process of denitrification that occurs when the bacteria, they use the energy from the carbon, and they literally eat or breathe in, if you will, the nitrates, and they breathe out nitrogen gas. And so if you're looking at, and I'm not going to talk anymore about anything but the rates that were given, in Illinois they had up to 60% of the nitrates removed from the tile drains. That's 60%, and now you got to do the calculation correctly. That's the diverted waters. So if it's a wet year, you get 60% of whatever you were able to divert. And if it's a wet year, a lot of the rest of the water went down the main because only a certain portion is actually diverted into the bioreactor. Iowa State has been studying it and actually has a design along with University of Illinois, and they're saying 15 to 60. I would say 15 on a wet year. I would say 60 on a dry year when most of the water is being diverted. Design methods are all nicely tabulated and everything, and in the state of Minnesota, this is all these designs are done by professional engineers. The second thing is a saturated buffer. It's also another practice. It does denitrifying. You can see it. This is a ditch, actually. It has a buffer on both sides. It's actually a 150-foot buffer, so you can see sort of get a feel for the scale here. Field tiles, this is the normal way. These are mains that are going out to the ditch. They're just shooting out into the ditch. But you have a three-chamber control box that's put on one of those. And then a diversion or a distribution tile. So we're instead of diverting into wood chips, we're now diverting into a perforated tile that goes out along the edge of this buffer. And with the idea that the water will build up and then be forced into the soil profile and then to the ditch through that water profile or through that soil profile. They have observation wells, and I haven't seen the latest data. I only saw the first year data. In the first year data, 100% of the nitrogen was removed from the water. And the reason for that is a number of reasons. One is that you've got a huge amount of uptake of the nitrogen in the vegetative growth. There's three levels of vegetation on here. There's grasses, forbs or shrubs type things, and then trees. And here's how it's put in. It's a simple task, cheaper than a bioreactor, and can be done by just about any tiler, actually. And then they use a distribution box just like you use in the drainage water management, as you do with the wood chip bioreactor. So you've got enhanced uptake, enhanced denitrification, because now the buggies, all the bugs that are in the soil, upper reaches of the soil, are also going after this, so they're denitrifying it. And then you got some surface discharge, and some we're looking at it now. The researchers are looking at the possibility of literally having surface discharge into a wetland, so that you'd have a surface denitrification occurring in a created wetland before it actually gets into the ditch. Problem that you do have, though, is if you get this bugger too close to the ditch line, you're going to slump. And this is the reason that it also is under an engineer's design standard at the present, because if you don't put that tile at the distribution line at the right place, potentially you're going to have a terrible maintenance problem along your ditch line. With that, I'm done.
Questions for Tim over here. I travel across western Minnesota quite often. I live in South Dakota. And in the last few years, I've continually seen, and I'm asking this as a question,
yeah.
I see the tiling going on everywhere, and I always ask myself, is there, which is really changing more, the tiling or the removal of windbreaks and tree rows and burning them up? And I'm wondering, could you give us a little insight about what the extent of tiling has gone on in the last few years, and particularly in western Minnesota?
I would say what we have seen is it's something that has moved from the Bois de Sioux is up in Moorhead kind of area, you know, and then if you head north of that, it has increased going north along the west side. Down in the Minnesota past the headwaters and down into the Minnesota, when you're down into the lobe, that's been going on a very long time in terms of their, I won't say tiled out, but they're coming close. The west and northwest along the Red River, that's just really getting a start, I'm afraid. There's a lot more yet to be done. Because they've been on one mile large ditches for a very, very long time. So now they're taking that property and beginning to make sure that they're dry and getting it out as quickly as they can using tile.
Yeah, we saw earlier today a wellhead protection area for the city of St. Peter, which it's pretty well known agricultural tiling discharges water into a permeable river terrace, mm-hmm. which is where the city wells were. The result of that is that the city is now paying on the order of about $2 million a year in order to maintain and keep the, you know, for capital and maintenance costs associated with removing the nitrogen. I think everyone would perhaps look at this and realize that this is an external cost associated with the agriculture. And I'm wondering what alternatives you might have for the city besides using their powers of eminent domain and condemning this property for future use and, you know, to make sure that the recharge is appropriate or it's handled appropriately. What other alternatives would they have? And do you think that $2 million a year would be enough?
I think we're over my pay grade. my boss works with a group of drainage stakeholders called the Drainage Work Group. There are a lot of, I won't call them loopholes, but the drainage is for a purpose. And agriculture has been given, has over the length of time, I think it's from the 1800s that the law was actually put in place, there hasn't been a lot of change in the purpose. The purpose is still get my property drained. And when we begin to talk about these kinds of things, this is the thing that's beginning to show the interaction between the urban and the rural. And it's a huge conversation
Check.
That we don't have an answer
Check.
For at the moment.
Check. Check. I don't know.
Testing? Are you dead?
I think we're getting some interference. alien invasion.
So did we answer the question? The question is, there's a lot of people talking about it.
Check.
But I'm not sure that we have answers for it yet.
Sam, is it good enough?
I'll tell you what. Everybody's chomping at the bit to go. Why don't you come on up and ask a question?
Yeah, that's good.
Those that want
that's
to talk
good.
A little more about it, come
I
on up.
I appreciate the fact that
we'll
you
still be
go.
Here. Wait. Wait. Be careful of that. No. November 12th, keep that on your radar screen. The fall MGWA conference will be the legacy and future of Superfund. It'll be very interesting. We've got keynote speaker, grand old man of the EPA, John Wilson, and others.